The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
As you will have heard in the news, five Al Jazeera personnel have been killed by an Israeli airstrike near a hospital in Gaza City. The five were in a tent for journalists at the hospital's main gate when it was struck by incoming Israeli fire. The Committee to Protect Journalists has said it was appalled by the attack and that it follows a pattern by Israel: kill a journalist and afterwards claim that the journalist is a terrorist. One of the reporters killed was Anas Al-Sharif, who left a message that if he were to be killed during the course of the war, he said he had lived the pain in all its details and that not even the mangled bodies of our children and women moved their hearts or stopped the massacre. He also expressed sorrow for those he was leaving behind, his wife and his children, who he will not see grow up. Now, the killing came after a press conference yesterday at which Benjamin Netanyahu said he would allow foreign journalists into the Gaza Strip, accompanied by the IDF, saying he believes their security can be assured. And within that context, Marwan Bishara, Al Jazeera's senior political analyst, gave these thoughts after the killing of his colleagues.
You need to understand here something. There's something psychopathic about this man, Netanyahu. There is something psychopathic. Not only that he's a psychopathic liar, I think he's a psychopathic murderer. Because the way he was describing how he guarantees the safety of journalists in Gaza, and the same day he bombs a tent of journalists, this is not normal. What do I mean by this is not normal? This is not normal criminality. This is a special kind of criminality. This is a psychopathic criminal that orders the killing of a journalist. And they're not denying it. They are not denying it. The same day they ordered the killing of our colleagues, five of them, is the day he told foreign journalists that he would be guaranteeing their safety. There's something sick about that.
And that's Marwan Bishara from Al Jazeera. Joining us now, Paul Rogers, Emeritus Professor of Peace Studies at Bradford University. Paul, good morning.
Good morning.
I mean, whether he's psychopathic or not, the jury might still be out on that, but certainly it's very cynical. Foreign journalists can come in to be protected by the IDF while the IDF are killing embedded journalists in Gaza City.
Yes, I mean, Al Jazeera has long had quite a large team in Gaza, but they're not people mostly from outside. They're people who actually are from Gaza and already working for Al Jazeera. And it looks like on this occasion, what the Israelis are about is to get rid of not just the key person, Anas Al-Sharif, who is very well known, but also another pretty senior reporter and three camera operators. So essentially, you're taking out, to use that terrible phrase, a core group of probably the main external view of what's happening in Gaza, because people have turned to Al Jazeera in very large numbers who wouldn't ordinarily look to Al Jazeera to find out what's really going on. And that's certainly true in countries like Britain, to a limited extent the United States, where it has some difficulty operating on occasions.
So if you consider cameramen as well as the reporters being taken out, those cameramen who are the eyes of the world, if you like, onto what's happening on in Gaza, they're just eliminating them. In other words, taking the eyes away.
That's right. And there have been well over 100 journalists and journal operators who've been killed over the last 2 years. I think there's probably a timing issue in this, in that Israel under Netanyahu is, if you like, going for broke. It wants to take over and garrison the whole of Gaza. And then it can do more or less what it wants in terms of moving people around. It's not proved possible to do that so far. With this humanitarian, so-called humanitarian group that's been giving out the aid, that's been at just four sites by and large, some others maybe on occasions. So that has really corralled people into small areas. That's not enough. There have been something like 1 million people still in Gaza City and the surrounding areas, and they really had to be brought under control. The problem, of course, is that, you know, if you stand back from all this, we're now 22 months into the war. We've got a couple of months to go before it's a 2-year marker. And essentially, Hamas has not been destroyed. It's been weakened. But there's very good evidence, including reports from very senior Israeli defense people, that in fact, Hamas probably has as many people willing to support it and actively supporting it as it did at the start of the war. In other words, the 10,000 or so people who have been killed have been replaced. And the reality now, I think, is whatever the Israelis do, they are creating more and more Hamas-type responses. But they're not able to see that. Why is a huge matter, but they're not able to see that. They're actually making themselves less secure, not more secure, by doing what they are.
Now, the question of more countries deciding to recognize a Palestinian state, the latest being Australia, with caveats like France and like the UK, certain caveats, they want to ensure that any government going forward in Gaza will not contain Hamas representatives. I mean, how realistic is that?
It may be quite realistic, but who is a Hamas representative? I mean, it may well be that Hamas ends up without having a named entity as part of governance. But the thing is, in personal terms, many of the people who really would be able technically to do this will be supporters of Hamas's aims in one state or another. Maybe not completely, but the point is you can't escape the fact that, you know, so many Palestinians have experienced so many problems that it's very difficult for them not to be opposed to Israel in the way, to some extent, that Hamas was. Now, Hamas, in a sense, at least officially, took it to extremes in that it demanded the end of Israel, although that seemed to have been softened in more recent statements. But essentially, the position we're in is that whatever happens in future, if any kind of Palestinian entity develops which really has power in another state, It will reflect the opinion of Palestinians. And given what they've been through in Gaza, and now, of course, in the West Bank, then you're going to get people who would support that kind of attitude. It's inescapable.
Now, Netanyahu's contention that the images we are all seeing on our screens of starving children, literally skin and bones, that these are not starving children, these are sick children.
Well, the problem with this is there is so much evidence coming from what one would have to say are independent sources. You've probably had it in Ireland, you certainly had it in Britain, paramedics, doctors, orthopedic surgeons and the rest working in Gaza, not just recently, but people have been going there for 15 years or so. These essentially are reporting back on what's really happening. So in a sense, Netanyahu would have to close up all kinds of medical support into Gaza to actually curb that. And that probably is a step that he cannot afford to take politically. No, I think the problem is that...
But I mean, who believes Netanyahu when he says the images you're seeing are not due to malnutrition, they are due to the fact that the children have a parallel illness, if you like, which, I mean, in itself is a cruelty given the lack of medical supplies, the lack of infant formula, the destruction of hospitals. Like there will be kids who are really suffering badly from disease and injury.
Which may not be treatable because of the conditions. Who is he intending it for? I think he's intending it for his main supporters within Israel. That may be a diminishing lot, but it still seems to be a majority of Israelis, according to opinion polls. It would also be for the supporters across the world of Israel. There are many Christian Zionists in the United States, some millions of them. And there will be people in most countries who will still take this, even though others would say, well, this is straightforward fake news. The numbers are probably very small, and the reality is that Israel is slipping more and more into being seeing a pariah or a rogue state, from which it will take decades, I would think, to recover it. It represents a signal change in Israel's security in terms of international relations, quite apart from anything else.
What did you make of the massive protest on the streets of Tel Aviv over the weekend?
That was very significant. It was mainly directed at the fact that people know full well in Israel that if Netanyahu goes ahead with this, the probability is that virtually none or very, very few hostages will survive. And so I think there's a real antagonism here. It's clear that there is a very sort of strong movement developing against Netanyahu. But the problem is that by and large, opinion polls published by Haaretz, the main liberal newspaper in Israel, are tending to show still strong support for the policy on Gaza, including, in fact, getting rid of all Palestinians out of Gaza. Certainly, an opinion poll 3 or 4 months ago suggested that a narrow but clear majority of Israelis would actually want that. They just want Gaza cleared out. That may be changing, and it may well be that new polls show differently, and that may be a reflection of the kind of demonstration that we saw at the weekend.
Now, it's very interesting, Marco Rubio coming out and saying that anyone who criticizes Israel will not be welcome in the United States. It's a peculiar thing because obviously it's quite possible to be interested in Israel's survival and well-being while being critical of the current government's policies there. But a contribution from Bernie Sanders over the weekend was very interesting because it really indicates where America's attitude to Israel may well be coming from. Have a listen.
The United Nations reports that more than 18,000 children have been killed since this war began. And I should mention that more than 12,000 of these children were under the age of 12, and more than 3,000 children in Gaza have had one or more limbs amputated. These are emaciated children, their bodies in some cases barely more than skeletons. The American people are seeing miles and miles of rubble where cities and towns once stood. They're seeing innocent people being shot down while they wait online to get food while they are starving. Over 1,000 people have been killed waiting online to get food because they are starving. Despite these war crimes carried out daily and in plain view, the United States has provided more than $22 billion for Israel's military operations since this war began. $22 billion. One estimate based on Brown University research calculates that the United States has paid for 70% of the Gaza war. In other words, American taxpayer dollars are being used to starve children, bomb schools, kill civilians, and support the cruelty of Netanyahu and his criminal ministers.
So, Paul, that really tells us this is America's war.
Well, that is what he is saying, and one has to admit that the evidence does support that. The Brown University, Brown is a leading Ivy League university. Its Watson Institute has long had this costs of war program, and it's been one of the major sources which was put together. What I think most people in the field regard as reliable information. And it does seem to be the case that essentially this is America's war in many ways. And to a small extent, it's also Britain's war because of our close involvement as well. But it does not actually impinge on the American psyche by and large. That is changing. And I think one has to recognize that what has happened recently with the pictures of the starving children and all the rest is that that is slowly changing in the United States as well. And I think essentially it's something which is being watched very carefully by the Trump administration. And probably the reason why you get a statement like that from Rubio, trying to sort of hold the fort, yeah, so to speak.
It's interesting. I was looking at a speech given by Jeffrey Sachs, the eminent economist who has worked in many different theatres with many different administrations and indeed with foreign governments in the post-collapse of the Soviet Union. And his contention is that Netanyahu back in the day was the inspiration for the invasion of Iraq, which Tony Blair and George Bush were involved in, but not France and Germany. And we played a clip of him some time ago on the program, Netanyahu, saying that it would all be sweetness and light once Iraq was dealt with. So this man has been a malign presence, given the misadventure that was the Gulf War II at the hands of George Bush.
Yes, I mean, Sachs has a very strong view on these things, but the problem is there is always something in it. And certainly Netanyahu has seen Iraq under Saddam Hussein as a major threat. And one has to remember that the Israelis themselves were rather burned when you actually had Iraqi missiles landing in Israel. And that's the occasion in one of the wars. So, yes, there is that feeling there. And I think the thing is that Netanyahu has a very single-minded view, obviously, of his own survival. But he sees that there is only one way for Israel to succeed, and that is to have the iron fist in the velvet glove, but always to have this power. And he's taken that farther, but one has to acknowledge that right since the founding of the State of Israel, Israel has had to look to its own security more than virtually any other country. And it has a sort of almost a psyche which is geared into that. And of course, it's aided also by having a largely, what you might call essentially a reserve army, so many reservists. The other side of the coin, of course, of that is that you're now seeing more and more opposition to what Netanyahu is saying coming from the Israeli military. And that, I think, is one of the bigger changes which we're starting to see on a large scale for the first time. And there are doubts whether the current head of the Israeli armed forces, the IDF, will actually stay in power. He may well resign if Netanyahu forces them to do what he wants in terms of garrisoning Gaza fully. So we're in strange times there in terms of changing moods. But overall, still, there is the support from the United States, and that seems to be extremely robust, at least at present.
Well, we're going to move to Ukraine now, where there's also U.S. involvement, as Donald Trump is due to meet with the Russian President Vladimir Putin in Alaska this coming Friday. They're hoping to discuss ways to end the war with Ukraine. That's Trump's ambition. What Putin is thinking is another matter entirely. Alarm bells have been sounded, though, because this meeting is being compared to the 1938 Munich Security Conference, where part of then Czechoslovakia was ceded to Adolf Hitler and to the Nazi German regime. So this was the response of NATO chief Mark Rutte when that comparison was put to him by Face the Nation moderator Margaret Brennan yesterday.
What will happen on Friday is testing Putin by President Trump. And I commend him for the fact that he organized this meeting. I think it is important. And obviously, when it comes to peace talks, the ceasefire, and what happens after that on territories, on security guarantees for Ukraine, Ukraine will have to be and will be involved. But on Friday, it is important to see how serious Putin is. And the only one who can do that is President Trump. So it's really crucial that a meeting takes place. It will not be the final say on this. There will not be the final deal on this. Of course, Ukraine will have to be involved and Europe. But it is important to start the next phase of this process, putting pressure on the Russians, exactly as President Trump has been doing over the last 6 months.
So we can see Mark Rutte still trying to fawn towards President Trump. And he was the one who called him daddy, after all, wasn't he? Anyway, let's talk about that, because it is concerning that Putin is still playing Trump.
Yes, he does seem to be. I mean, this is Trump, who claims to be the world's great deal maker, that does not seem to succeed at all when it comes to Putin. Who knows why? It's very difficult to say, and there are all sorts of rumours which you always get on these occasions. But I think the reality is that whether anybody likes it or not, this is a war which is in a violent stalemate. I know we used that term before, because in one sense, neither side can win and neither side can lose. If Ukraine was really losing, then NATO would be forced to come to its aid even more, simply because NATO's status would be at stake. And if the Russians are losing, they could threaten to escalate. To some extent, well, we know it has to end at the negotiating table, and there had to be some give and take from both sides. It's worth remembering that when Putin went into this originally, what he wanted to do was to completely change the Ukraine regime and get a client state. That was the original aim, and it failed in the first 2 or 3 months when he had to withdraw a best part of all the third of all the troops who were in Ukraine. But the reality now is it is a stalemate, and there will have to be some give on both sides. And it's very uncomfortable, and one has to look back to where this came from originally, why it was that Putin was able to develop this idea of taking over part of Ukraine, originally trying to actually take control almost of the whole country, and where mistakes were made earlier on, right back in the 1990s and certainly in the recent past. But this is where we are, and I think there's going to be a crunch. And as far as one can tell, talking to people who know Ukraine well, most people in Ukraine know there has to be an ending, it has to be negotiated, and there will have to be some give. But once you get any kind of movement, that is when, if you get even the beginnings of a ceasefire, that is when you can get the more professional people coming in, the mediators and the rest, and work out whether some compromises can be reached. Nobody really thinks there can be any compromise over Crimea because of its huge importance to Russia. Other parts, that may vary, but even so, it's going to be very difficult because the Russians have been prepared to see tens of thousands of their own people killed, and killed on a sort of long-term basis. And that's where we are. It's extremely uncomfortable to say it, but there's going to have to be some loss of territory on Ukraine's part. Most Ukrainian people, apparently, as far as one can see, accept this, but they do want an end to the war.
But you think that it's the element of Crimea, which has been taken over since 2014 by the Russians, that might be the price that Ukrainians would have to pay whereas the existing occupied territories in the rest of Ukraine would not be acceptable to Zelensky and his people?
I think whether they are acceptable or not to Zelensky and the Ukrainians, and the different matter is what the Americans think. Because obviously other people would say, well, you have to remember that these parts of Ukraine were basically largely Russian-speaking parts of Ukraine. And they're actually very close to the Soviet Union in the old days and to Russia more recently. Many people having houses on both sides, so to speak. So it's not quite straightforward. And this is where I think many in Ukraine agree and know full well that it is not just Crimea, which is almost taken as read. It's much more a case of the whole of the Donbass region and areas around that and what gives that has to be there. And that is very difficult because probably the best one we'll get at present is some sort of ceasefire based on current borders. Current front lines. And that, of course, means that at least on a temporary basis, Russia will be in control of areas, not at a time of war. And that's the real difficulty, and one which I think many people will find trouble swallowing, but it probably is going to have to be swallowed.
But you can imagine that were Russia to get control of these areas, and therefore the borders would have to be erected, border controls, trying to rule that part of Ukraine with a considerable chunk of the enemy within might be quite difficult.
I think it would probably be impossible. And this is where it really gets far more difficult in terms of how you go. But the trouble is that given what has happened now, given bluntly Putin's nature, given the mistakes that have been made in Western countries in the past, go back to the possibility of the Minsk agreement for a start, then essentially this is where we are. And although there can be negotiations, the reality is that Russia will not get control of Ukraine. It will not be able to extend its sphere of influence territory right through into borders with Poland and the rest. That won't happen. And in that sense, that is what Putin wants. And Putin has failed in doing that. But he will have got something. But the reality, of course, is you now have a larger NATO with Sweden and Finland involved. You have a pretty terrible arms race going on involving Russia and several Western countries. And if anything, it means that any possibility of a future war would be hugely dangerous because you would have much higher levels of armaments. But that is the price that we're going to have to pay. And hopefully, good sense will prevail. But at the moment, it isn't. I don't think it will as long as we have Trump in the White House.
Are we paying the price for the United States? And this is the Jeffrey Sachs analysis as well, deciding to push east with NATO when it was thought that that would not be advisable or even fair to Russia.
Well, I think that is certainly at the root of this, and it was NATO's determination. And Americans and others, I mean, there were hawks in Britain and elsewhere who basically really saw Russia. You've got to go back to 1993, 94. When Russia was in a heck of a mess, it had embraced a sort of a hyperversion of capitalism. The economy is in deep disarray. But the crucial thing was at that time, to a very large extent, Russia was treated as basically a failed state. It was treated with a degree of contempt by many Western politicians. They've lost, that's it. That changed the mood, we've won. And that really had a terrible effect, with Putin as being brilliantly clever at reminding Russians of. Now, that doesn't have quite such an effect on younger Russians, but certainly Russians over the age of 40 or 45 is quite deeply embedded in many of them, not all, but many of them. And essentially, that sort of victory view in the 1990s is one of the reasons why Putin was able to come in, play very tough, and succeed in doing so, and basically have quite a lot of popularity, even though Russia itself today is extremely autocratic, and it's very difficult to have any sort of disagreement internally.
Finally, as I suppose a parallel point, but relevant nonetheless, the taco president, Trump always chickens out. He set a deadline for Friday. We remember that Obama said the line of using chemical weapons in Syria would not be crossed. If it was, there would be consequences. There were none. And we have Trump threatening Russia with consequences. And really, there are none. Instead, there's the reward of a meeting in Alaska. I mean, did Taco Trump do it again?
It certainly looks that way. But one also has to remember that when you're dealing with these kinds of interchanges, they're really very unpredictable. This is why it probably makes very little sense to have these big public pronouncements. It's much better to say this is what we are prepared to do in these circumstances privately, behind the scenes. But Trump is not that style. He does not have that style. It's all out in the open. But bit by bit, I think the taco thing will eventually stick to him. Because, you know, the whole idea this war would be over in the first day of his administration, that turned out to be nonsense. This is probably a weakness of Trump. But in the short term, a large proportion of people who support him will buy into that. The real issue is how long that is going to last, whether Trump himself will tend to find more and more difficulty internally in the United States, and whether that in turn will make him and the people around him even more prepared to play it as tough as they can domestically as well as internationally.
Paul Rogers, Emeritus Professor of Peace Studies at Bradford University. Paul, thank you very much for joining us.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.